Hello, I'm Maddie Westbrook and I'm the General Manager here at Dr. Libby HQ. I'm delighted to be hosting this audio session today with Dr. Libby as she answers some of the questions posed to her by people in her online course. We've got questions about emotional eating, perimenopause, what to do when your hair is falling out, what could be causing insatiable sugar cravings, and why people say that sleep before midnight is worth twice than that after midnight. For those of you who aren't familiar with the course I'm talking about, four times a year we have an intake for Dr. Libby's Weight Loss for Women online course. In this course, you'll get daily emails, educational videos, and a bunch of resources and recipes from Dr. Libby across 9 weeks. Plus, as well as getting the chance to ask questions anytime they like in the forum, participants have two opportunities to submit questions to Dr. Libby and she answers them via audio, just like this, for the group. As you can see, they don't have to be questions about weight loss either. We get many, many questions about a range of health challenges, from perimenopause to sleeping to hair. So it is a fantastic opportunity just to pose your questions to Dr. Libby. We wanted to give you a little sample of what this audio question and answer session was like. So we've taken some of the questions from previous intakes and Dr. Libby will answer these for us today. I hope you love it as much as I do. And I hope you learn a lot. With that little introduction out of the way, let's get started and welcome Dr. Libby to the microphone.
Thanks so much, Maddie. So fun to do this.
So fun. Okay, we've got a range of questions today, and they're not just all about weight loss, but also about health in general, which I guess is a great thing about this course. You don't just have to be doing it with weight loss as the focus. So for those of you who love learning, buckle up and let's get started on these questions. Our first question is from Sonia in Christchurch. She asks, I have a question regarding emotional eating. I'm finding that my biggest challenge is eating on autopilot standing at the fridge. I find this so hard to stop as it does give me a level of comfort and a chance to numb out. And I'm finding it hard to change this ingrained habit. Can you suggest some ways in which I can start to tackle this?
Sonia, it's such a good question and it's one we get in so many of our online courses. So please know that you're not alone in feeling this way. So, and certainly the first step is actually noticing you do this. So well done on being aware that this is something that's going on. You've identified that you don't actually feel hungry and you can see that it's a tool that you use to change how you feel. So I guess my first question would be, is that actually working for you? Do you actually feel the way you want to feel? You're trying to numb out, you say, are you actually achieving that with making that choice of overeating in that way? And my guess is the answer is probably no, because I'd say as soon as you stop eating, you just add to the worry you had before the binge eating, because now you'll probably beat yourself up about binging and worry about that too. So I think it's incredibly important to recognize that sometimes what we attempt to ask food to do for us, it can't actually do that. Another common scenario, people will say, I want food to comfort me. Food can't do that. It can't hug you. It can't say, thanks for making my bed every day for the last 18 years. You're a wonderful person. It can't tell us how appreciated we are. So we often ask food to do things that it can't do for us. So to help you start to break this habit, if you like, that you're in, the first step, awareness. The second step is I'll give you an idea. And it's not about forbidding anything, because when we forbid ourselves to do something, it often makes it more appealing to us. So I just want you to bring curiosity to what you're actually doing. You might like to keep a little notebook in the kitchen. So when this desire to binge arises, before you eat anything, you need to go and fill in your little book. So you roll up the book into four columns. And the first column asks the question, what do I want? So when you get this desire to binge eat, you go and look at that and think, okay, what do I want? And you have to answer that question. So what are you feeling like? Is it ice cream? Is it biscuits? Is it chocolate, lollies? What is it? So write that down. What do I want? Okay, it's ice cream. But you know that you're not hungry because you only had your dinner an hour earlier. So you know it's not a physical hunger. You can see, as you've identified in your question, it's more a desire to change how you feel. And the numbing out that you described. So then you answer the second question, which you write at the top of the second column. And that question is, what do I really want? And at first your brain will probably go, I just want ice cream, for goodness sake. But push yourself further and just keep asking that question over and over again until some new answers start to come out. So what do I really want? What do I really want? Well, I can see that I really want to renovate the bathroom. I really want to go on a holiday. I really want someone to hug me. I really want to have a conversation where someone really listens to me and they don't judge judge me. I really want to have a baby. Whatever it is, you identify what it is that you really want. The third column, that question is, how would having that make me feel? Because even though you've identified some things that you want, it's still not about having those things, because those things too, you may want them, but they're also going to change how you feel. We are completely governed by how we feel. So the third column says, how would having that make me feel? And whatever your answer was, well, that would make me feel loved, appreciated, comforted, supported, alive, excited. So you actually identify the emotion that you're looking to feel. And then that's then in the fourth column that you've drawn up in your little book that's in the kitchen, you say to yourself, how else can I experience that in a way that doesn't hurt my health? And write down all of your answers. The first person I ever did this with had been through quite a traumatic experience, and she was consuming nearly a whole cheesecake every night after dinner. And it was very obvious that comfort and essentially love was what she was looking for. And so in her fourth column, one of the things we came up with for her to do was, before she let herself eat the cheesecake, she had to go and watch her two little twin daughters sleeping and do that for 10 minutes. So not notice their messy bedrooms, just notice how one of them might be, you know, freezing cold and she's got her duvet pulled up around her neck and the other one's boiling hot and she's thrown hers off and she's got a leg sticking out of the bed. Just notice how precious they are. And for the first month that this lady did this, before she would let herself go and eat, she actually only then went and ate three times in that first month after that. So it doesn't necessarily take away that desire to binge eat, but it gives you a feeling that you're looking for that's not going to hurt your health, and it will often then lead you to not want to go there. So that's a simple little tool that you can consider, and I really hope that's useful, Sonia.
I love that. And I also love what you said about it piling on, you know, when you eat emotionally, it piling on the worry. So this technique that you shared gives them a bit of a path out. It's really awesome. Okay, our next question is Amanda from Melbourne. She says, I'm in my late 40s and anticipating perimenopause. What can I do to support my health during this transition?
So I think probably not everyone will know what perimenopause is. So let's start there. Perimenopause is the stage we go through between regular menstruation and being postmenopausal. So by definition, menopause is one day. It's the 12-month anniversary from your last period, and it really only lasts for that day. And then beyond that, you're postmenopause. But in the lead up to your day of menopause, you go through what's called perimenopause, which is that transition away from regular menstruation. Now, not everybody knows that they're going through perimenopause. For some women, there's absolutely no symptoms. There's just a gentle petering out of their hormones. But for a lot of women these days, perimenopause is a year to 12 years in length, or anywhere in between that. And it can be a time where the hormones are enormously fluctuating. So let's dig into those hormones. When we make the majority of our progesterone after we ovulate, and through the perimenopausal years, we aren't ovulating every single cycle anymore. So on the cycles where we don't ovulate, we rely completely on our little adrenal glands, which sit just on top of our kidneys, to make a small amount of progesterone. Now, sure, progesterone has reproductive functions, but it also has a lot of biological functions. Get a load of what they are. But progesterone is a powerful anti-anxiety agent. It's an antidepressant and it's a diuretic, so it allows you to get rid of excess fluid. So imagine on the months where you don't ovulate, you're not making very much, if any, of this really powerful hormone that stops you having a lot of anxious feelings. So one of the common symptoms that can kick in with perimenopause is a difference with sleeping and the depth of our sleep, the quality of our sleep, and almost like a heart racing feeling where, and your thoughts often will join in with that racing kind of anxious feeling. So that's the progesterone dropping. Plus, across those perimenopausal years, estrogen is often like a roller coaster. Sometimes it surges, sometimes it plummets. And when it surges, you can get really irritable. And when it plummets, you can go to a really low mood. And that's often when the hot flushes will kick in as well. So it's a critical time to look after yourself, as every day really is. But especially across those perimenopausal years, it's incredibly important to support yourself, which is why this is such a good question. So you first want to look after the adrenal glands because, as you just heard me explain, they're going to be the only source of progesterone for you moving forward. So you want them to be able to make some progesterone. The trouble is they are also the site of our stress hormone production. Our stress hormones are adrenaline and cortisol. So when you're primarily producing a lot of those stress hormones, your body won't often allow you, it doesn't think it's wise for you to make very much, if any, progesterone. So looking after the adrenals and really examining your stress is incredibly important, which I know is easier said than done. I'll touch on a couple of ways we can do that in a moment. And then, of course, we need to look after the liver because the liver is responsible for our estrogen metabolism, and you don't want to be recycling estrogen. So for estrogen to be eliminated from the body effectively, the gut bacteria first have to address it, and then the liver has to take over what happens to estrogen. And you want, estrogen's beautiful when you've got the right amount of it, but it's really challenging when you are recycling it, which is what will happen if the liver is what we call congested and not able to fully detoxify and allow the estrogen to leave your body. So the ways we look after our liver, we need to be really honest with ourselves about how many of what I call the liver loaders are going in. So things like caffeine and alcohol and refined sugar, the trans fats, which are found in processed cakes and biscuits, muesli bars, synthetic substances, things like pesticides, certain medications that aren't essential. So they're some of the things that the liver's got to work on. So minimizing those where you can. And then you want to add the things that really support the good functioning of the liver. So the liver loves bitter food. So green leafy vegetables, particularly the brassica vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts. And then there are also some beautiful medicinal herbs, things like St. Mary's thistle, globe artichoke. So there's some ideas for the estrogen. And then rounding back to the adrenal support for good progesterone production, the breath work. So particularly a lovely long, slow exhalation can really help to lower stress hormones effectively, which then will support your own progesterone production. So that's certainly one way to go. There are also some beautiful herbs that can support the adrenals as well, things like Siberian ginseng, peonia and licorice that can really help to foster your own innate progesterone production for as long as possible. So there's a couple of things for you to think about there to support yourself across this transition, Amanda.
That's so great. And Amanda mentioned she was in her late 40s. Is that something that people should start focusing on once they experience symptoms? Can they start earlier?
It's really, Maddie, something I think that we need to always be considering as women. So often we don't address something until it's causing us problems, but understanding our sex hormones, I think, is such an important thing for women of all ages, and we're never too young or too old to start to learn about them. So preparing for that transition can make the world of difference to that transition being really challenging and pretty smooth sailing. So everything I just talked about with looking after the liver, looking after the adrenals, it can make a really big difference to that transition being smooth once it does actually arrive.
Great. Our next question is in regards to hair. So Liz from Perth asks, my hair is starting to thin around my hairline, and I'm wondering if there is anything I could add to my diet to help stop this.
So a concept I love to share, Liz, is one that I call the road in is the road out. So in other words, you need to understand what has led to the hair falling out. So some really common reasons include sex hormone imbalances, thyroid problems, or certain nutrient deficiencies. Iron and zinc deficiencies are common deficiencies. So with a sex hormone imbalance, often it's due to low progesterone, which we just touched on. It can also be due to elevated androgens. Androgens are male sex hormones, so testosterone is an androgen, and sometimes also prolactin is elevated. So it's really useful to have those tested, because then you will know if they're out of whack, then you will know if that's what's contributing to the hair loss. Postmenopausally, low estrogen can also lead to hair thinning. So I'm not sure what stage you're up to with that, but that's also another, you could have that measured as well and have a test for that as well. If it's the thyroid scenario, if that's the road into the hair loss, then correcting the thyroid problem, if that's possible, is incredibly important. So the thyroid needs certain nutrients to work effectively. It needs iodine, selenium, iron, and zinc. So if you're deficient in, say, iodine, when you add some iodine back to how you're eating, then your thyroid function is likely to improve because the road in for you was iodine deficiency. Now you've got some iodine going in and your thyroid function might improve. But another reason the thyroid may not work effectively or efficiently or as well as it once did can be what's called estrogen dominance. So along the lines of what I touched on in the previous answer, where progesterone is low and estrogen is in excess, this is in the second half of the menstrual cycle, typically. When you've got way too much of that estrogen in the second half of the cycle compared to progesterone, and that happens long term, then that can suppress thyroid function as well. So if you have a thyroid that's not working effectively, that's causing your hair loss, but the thyroid's not working properly because of estrogen dominance, then the iodine won't fix that. Resolving the estrogen dominance will, and then that will resolve the hair picture. So if that's what I mean by the road in is the road out. And it's why in all of my work, it's why I kind of call myself the why girl, because I want to work out why. Why is this happening for someone rather than just put a Band-Aid over the top of it? Then the third thing I said that could be contributing to hair loss just all on its own are nutrient deficiencies. And certainly these days, iron is the most common nutrient deficiency among Western women, particularly of menstruation age. So some iron-rich foods include red meat, liver, eggs, and there's small amounts in green leafy vegetables, dates, and also in lentils. And it can be tricky for us today to actually get enough iron to meet our needs. So supplementation is sometimes needed. So, but certainly iron deficiency can contribute to hair loss. So there might be some, your first step in hearing this might be to actually go and have some blood tests. It might be really useful to measure those sex hormones I mentioned, have your thyroid tested, and also have your iron studies tested so that you know where you're at, and then take steps to correct whatever it is that's gone awry. So I hope that's helpful.
I love that. And you often share that our beauty bits, so our hair, skin and nails, can give us insight into our health. And that's essentially what Liz has found out here. Her hair, she's noticed that her hair is thinning and it could be an iron deficiency. So the body is pretty awesome.
It is, and gives us, and it's a great point you raise, Maddie, because it allows us then to almost have the body as a barometer. It doesn't have a voice, but if we notice changes and then we act to correct those changes, it can improve our health in all sorts of ways, not just the visible bits we can see.
Kylie from Auckland has a question in regards to headaches. She frequently suffers with a terrible headache in the 3 to 4 days before her period. She says, I'm guessing it's due to a hormonal imbalance. Do you have any suggestions as to what I can do to stop this from happening?
Oh, Kylie, I feel for you because it's really challenging and you sort of know it's coming around each month, don't you, and almost dread it turning up. So it's so great that you've asked this question. The most common scenario in my clinical work that I have seen contribute to this is what I call estrogen dominance. So estrogen is supposed to be the dominant hormone in the first half of our menstrual cycle. So from day one is the first day of bleeding. Day 14 is the middle of the cycle, roughly when we ovulate. So for those first 14 days, estrogen is supposed to be dominant. And then in the second half of the cycle from day 14, pretty much onwards through to when we bleed around day 28, 29, progesterone is supposed to be dominant. But for so many women, progesterone is too low in the second half of the cycle and there's way too much estrogen. And it's the excess of estrogen over the progesterone in the lead up to the period that can lead to these headaches. So that is possibly happening for you 3 to 4 days leading into your period. So sometimes the estrogen excess is coming from lifestyle choices. So you might be having way too many of the liver load, as I mentioned in a previous question. So way too much alcohol, refined sugars, trans fats, for example. You might live a really hectic life. And so you're living on way too much takeaway food or processed food. So making a conscious choice to perhaps prepare some more food on a Sunday so that you've got more whole real food going forward for the week, if you resonate with what I've just said, can be a way to include more things like the green leafy vegetables, particularly those brassica vegetables that the liver loves. It would also be important to make sure that you've got good progesterone levels. So making sure that you're examining your stress, that you're exploring perceptions of pressure and urgency. Caffeine also leads the body to make stress hormones. So making sure that your adrenaline levels aren't too high, because that will say to the body that your life's in danger. And I don't say that lightly. Adrenaline has always meant that in our chemistry, and the body links progesterone to fertility. So it'll say to the body, well, we don't want you to bring a baby into a world because we don't think you're safe because of all of this adrenaline. So keeping that in mind as well. So essentially, we want to decrease the estrogen, not too low because it's a really important hormone, but it sounds like it's way too high. So that requires a big liver focus. So decreasing those liver loaders, increasing those green leafy veggies, especially the brassicas. You might want to add some liver herbs like St. Mary's thistle, globe, artichoke. And clinically, I want to add, so when I was seeing patients one-on-one, I quite often, it would be highly dependent on the person's history, but if they had a streptococcus illness-based history, so things like tonsillitis, ear infections, bronchitis, croup, those types of health conditions are caused by usually a streptococcus bacteria. And so I would ask that person to be dairy-free as a trial, not forever, just as a trial, for usually for two menstrual cycles, along with that liver support. And quite often that combination was really effective. So obviously what I'm sharing is for education purposes. I don't know your thorough health history, but that could be a really great place for you to start.
And in terms of if someone does suspect that they might fit that profile of having estrogen excess or low progesterone, is that something that you go to the doctor and ask for a blood test for? Is that effective? Are you better to use your body as a guide in terms of the symptoms you're experiencing?
It really depends on your own nature. Some people love to see things written on paper. So, and you can test hormones in lots of different ways, blood, urine, and saliva. I'm happy with any of those. You just want to work with a practitioner who knows how to interpret your results. And also you don't ever compare, say, saliva testing with blood testing. You always compare, say, blood with blood. If you're going to test your hormone levels in blood, you want to do it on day 21 of your menstrual cycle, because that will show you, that's when progesterone is supposed to peak. And that's where you'll see the really strong relationship between estrogen and progesterone. And then Kylie, for you, you're saying then just a couple of days later, two or so days later, that's when your headaches kick in. So you'll sort of see the lead up to it there from a hormonal profile, if you want to do that. Or other people don't need to see things on paper. They're just happy to go with their symptoms. And it might be that you want to read a book more to learn more about your hormones. So that might be a way to go for you.
Great. Now, our next question is from a lady all the way in America, Marcella from Miami. She has a daughter who is almost 12. And herself, she says she is 39, nearly 40. And they have both recently gone vegetarian for ethical reasons. Her question is, I wonder if it is possible to get a balanced diet, especially around iron, B12, and anything else that can be depleted from no meat without additional supplements, or if we should be having a supplement. I am still menstruating regularly and my daughter is just hitting puberty. Thank you, Dr. Libby.
Okay, so usually you can still meet all your requirements when you're eating in a vegetarian way, because when people eat in a vegetarian way, they're usually including eggs and dairy. For a vegan, there's zero animal foods. And I highlight that just sometimes people mix the words up. So the answer that I give you is going to be based on vegetarian, because that's what you've said in your question. So, because the reason it's important to clarify is animal foods are the only source of vitamin B12. Plant food don't contain any B12. So if someone was vegan, then B12 definitely needs to be supplemented. But being vegetarian, you'll still be obtaining this if you're eating the eggs and the dairy foods, so if you eat those. But it's definitely iron and zinc that you will need to be mindful of. You can get them, but you need to be very aware of obtaining these nutrients in adequate amounts. So given you are menstruating and your daughter is about to start, then iron especially is the one to watch. It's the most common deficiency among women of menstruation age. A menstruating female needs 18 milligrams of iron per day just to prevent deficiency. So that's not even necessarily for optimal health. That's just to prevent deficiency. So just to give you some context around that, I'll list some foods or the way an omnivorous eater, so someone who eats meat and vegetables, the way they would get 18 milligrams of iron, and then I'll do a vegetarian version just so you can get a gist. So breakfast for an omnivorous eater might be two eggs, a cup of raw spinach, so about 30 grams, half a tomato, and 2 slices of good quality whole grain bread. Morning tea, 30 grams of cashews and a banana. Lunch, 200 grams of some kind of fish, say tuna or salmon, 1/2 cup of cooked kidney beans, 1 cup of brown rice, 100 grams of mixed vegetables. Afternoon tea might include 2 dried figs. So I'm only listing here foods that contain iron. And then dinner, 200 grams of cooked beef or lamb, 1/2 cup of broccoli and a medium potato. So those food, there'll be other foods obviously people have. I'm not saying that that's what you have for your breakfast, lunch and dinner and your snacks, but just to give you an example, that's a day of eating that'll give you, to be precise, 18.6 milligrams of iron. Then for a vegetarian, a way that they could get their iron going in, say 100 grams of a good quality muesli that contains dried fruit and nuts. If you have one with dried fruit, always make sure it's preservative free. 30 grams of cashews and a banana for morning tea, 1 cup of cooked chickpeas, 1/2 cup of broccoli, 1 cup of cooked quinoa and 30 grams of walnuts at lunchtime. Middle of the afternoon, you might have 1 slice of a good quality whole grain bread and 1 tablespoon of peanut butter. And then for dinner, 100 grams of tempeh, which is fermented soybeans, 1 cup of raw spinach, 100 grams of mixed vegetables and 1 cup of cooked brown rice. That's going to give you 18.4 milligrams. However, you need to do that every day. And the challenge is that so many people wouldn't go anywhere near that on a daily basis. And you need the minimum of the 18 milligrams every single day to prevent the deficiency. The other challenge is that when we're obtaining our iron-based foods primarily from plants, it's a different form of iron. So in meat, it's called heme iron, and in the plants, it's called non-heme iron. And we need some extra usually need vitamin C paired with that to absorb it effectively. And nature often packages food up in that way. So parsley, for example, contains a small amount of iron, and it's also got the vitamin C in it to enhance that absorption. But the other little challenge with a lot of the plant-based foods is that they can contain substances like phytates that can actually block the absorption of iron. So where there's a decent amount of fiber, we won't necessarily get the iron or all of the iron that's in that food. We won't actually absorb that and obtain that. So there's some suggestion to say that a vegetarian needs about 1.8 times the amount of iron that an omnivorous eater would eat. So there's no problem, of course. It's a beautiful decision that you've made, but it's a great question that you've asked. So the iron is the really big one that you need to be mindful of. You can have it measured, though, and it's important, I think, probably each year for all women, regardless of how we eat. It's a really good test, a good thing to have tested each year. You need to ask, though, for iron studies to be tested, because quite often they'll only test your ferritin, which is your iron storage. But when you ask for iron studies, there are 4 blood tests involved in that, and it gives you a really good idea of what's happening with your own iron metabolism. And if you do that for you and your daughter once a year, you will then have great confidence in knowing where you're at, and then you either change how you're eating or you add a supplement if that's appropriate to make sure that you've got enough there. As I touched on, zinc is the other one that can be tricky to obtain enough of as a vegetarian, because the richest food sources we have are oysters and red meat. There's a really small amount of zinc in eggs and also in seeds like pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds. But again, it can be challenging to eat enough of these to meet the requirements. So that's another nutrient just to be mindful of. You can have a blood test for that as well and adjust your food or take a supplement if needed.
That's so fascinating. And with the food list, I found myself thinking, oh, I don't really think about iron when I'm having my breakfast or when I'm having my snacks. You know, it tends to be something you focus on for an evening meal. So it's good to just be aware that you can get iron throughout the day. Now, our next question is Diane from Hamilton. Hi, Dr. Libby. I'm 49 and I used to have a 28-day cycle, but for the last year, it has been 21 days or thereabouts. I would be grateful if you could please explain what would be going on with my hormones for this change to occur.
So, again, another really common scenario. Essentially, your progesterone has dropped lower. It's a bit of a common theme we're seeing through today's questions, actually. So, Reproductively, one of progesterone's job is to hold the lining of the uterus in place. And so when we bleed more frequently, it usually means that our progesterone level is lower than where it was when the cycle was 28 days in length. So the progesterone is falling away too soon. And as I touched on in a previous answer, at 49, it's likely you are in perimenopause, that transition from menstruation to being postmenopause. There's no telling, of course, how long perimenopause will go on for or when your periods will actually cease. But for now, yes, you will have less progesterone than previously. And this may or may not also mean you have an excess amount of estrogen for some of the second half of the cycle. But the biggest focus here needs to be on the progesterone, as one of the concerns with bleeding too often is iron deficiency, plus the increase in anxious feelings, the low mood, the fluid retention that low progesterone can bring. And just not even those things, just the ripple effect of that in our lives can be quite significant when, particularly if it's something that's new for you, it can be really concerning and very uncomfortable. So there are numerous strategies to start to assist this low progesterone type picture. And again, obviously this is for education purposes because I don't know your health history, but I can share with you what's made a difference for others in this situation. So the adrenal herbs, things like Siberian ginseng, the peonia and the licorice, they help the adrenals to make progesterone, and it also fosters really good communication between a gland in our brain called the pituitary gland and the ovaries, because it's actually the pituitary gland that signals to the ovaries that it's time to release an egg. So when you've got good pituitary ovarian communication and reliable ovulation, then you tend to get a much better surge of progesterone. So those herbs can help to foster that really good communication. Other things that can help through various mechanisms support improved progesterone are things like magnesium, taurine, which is an amino acid. Some people do prefer to use what are called bioidentical hormones, so a micronized progesterone, which would be prescribed by an integrative GP if that's the road you want to go down. But certainly embracing a breath-focused practice can be incredibly impacting. I know it sounds too simple to make a difference when I talk about the breath work, but the reason it makes such a difference is because when we extend the length of our exhalation, so when we slow our breathing right down to be lovely, long, slow breaths, you communicate to your body that you're safe, because you would never be able to breathe like that if your life was actually in danger. And unfortunately, we tend to sit round at our desks all day, breathing in a short, sharp, shallow way in the top of our chest. And that's stress hormones drive that. So when we breathe in this lovely, long, slow way, we lower our stress hormones quite effectively. So just incorporating a breath-focused practice, Tai Chi, restorative yoga, stillness through movement, Pilates, or just getting rituals in your day when you stopped at red traffic lights, when you're boiling the kettle in the morning to make lemon juice in warm water, of course, you do some lovely long slow breaths instead of racing around the house and doing 50,000 other jobs. Another thing I think that's incredibly important when we're looking to support our progesterone production again is exploring our perceptions of pressure and urgency, because things have become, well, they have been for ages now, but life can feel so intense, and we tend to not function in a very relaxed way sometimes, and we often don't even realize that we're sort of feeling so tense in our body. So really exploring our perceptions of pressure and urgency so that we can save those moments for when we really need them can also help to decrease our stress hormone production, and all of that then supports better progesterone, which potentially can lengthen out your cycle again.
Thank you. And the breath work is so powerful, even just sitting here listening to you say that. I've extended the length of my exhale and I feel exponentially better. Our next question is Jen from Sydney. She wants to talk about sugar cravings. Can you kindly shed light on what could be causing absolutely insatiable sugar cravings? I'm 25 and I just don't get it. I find them so hard to resist.
Jen, you are not alone. My goodness, this is just so common, which I know doesn't make it feel any better for you right now. But let's have a look at what can be behind some of these sugar cravings. You probably are aware there are three pillars to my work: the nutritional, the biochemical, and the emotional. So when I think about sugar cravings, I tend to look at it from all of those perspectives, or you might just want to break it down into physical, like a physical need for some glucose, for some sugar, or emotional. So let's do the physical ones first. So some physical reasons you might crave sugar is that you're having fluctuations in your blood glucose levels. So what leads to those? Glucose ends up in the blood when we consume carbohydrates, with stress, and also with caffeine. And I'll elaborate on these three. So we get the glucose predominantly into our blood when we consume carbohydrates, and our carbohydrates are our starchy foods and our sugary sweet foods. Okay, so anything that is a carbohydrate gets broken down into glucose. That all occurs in our digestive system. And then the glucose moves from our digestive system across into our blood. So therefore, our blood glucose levels go up. So the amount of glucose in our blood is fluctuating because of poor quality food choices and relying on too many processed, highly sugary foods, that can drive some of those fluctuations. The second thing is stress. So, and it's not talked about enough in relation to sugar cravings. So one of our stress hormones in it is adrenaline. And I said a moment ago how adrenaline, for the 300,000 years that humans have been on the planet, adrenaline used to only ever be made when our life was literally in danger. But now what leads us to produce adrenaline predominantly is more psychological stress. So worrying about what other people think of us, feeling like everything is urgent and needed to be done yesterday. That all leads to adrenaline production. And so when we've got all of that adrenaline in our blood, because it's saying our life's in danger, the body then thinks it needs a fast burning fuel to help you get out of danger. So if you haven't eaten for a couple of hours, you won't have as much glucose in your blood in that moment, but you've got glucose stored in your liver and your muscles in a form called glycogen. And so the adrenaline can actually send a message to the liver and the muscles to release the glycogen. We turn it back into glucose in our blood, and up your blood glucose level goes. So then after a stressful experience, that elevation in blood glucose is going to fall again. And when it falls, you'll crave your sugar. So that's another scenario. And then the third one was caffeine. And it's essentially what I just said with stress, but I make it a separate little component for you to consider it separately. So caffeine also leads the human body to produce adrenaline. I know no one ever wants to hear that, and I'm really sorry that it does, but it's just what happens. It's just one of its biological functions. So with that surge of adrenaline, the same thing happens as with stress. If you haven't eaten for a while, a message will be sent to your liver, to your muscles, to release the glycogen, turn it back into glucose, and up your blood glucose level goes. So after that will eventually then crash. And when it crashes, that's when you'll crave the sugar. So sometimes it's because of food choices we're making. Sometimes it's because of stress. And sometimes it's because of caffeine. So I give those three to you so you can see what resonates for you and then start to make some adjustments. A lot of people are caught up in a really vicious cycle. They warm up with caffeine. They get stressed all through the day. And then the sugar cravings hit in the middle of the afternoon. And we give in and we eat something there that's lousy quality. We know better. We know we're not supposed to be making a choice like that. And then we berate ourselves. We tell ourselves we've ruined it. And then when you tell yourself you've ruined it, you think, oh, what the heck, I'll just eat anything. And so that's when you go home and smash a whole thing of cheese and biscuits. And then you have your dinner. And then you think, oh, ruined it ages ago. I might as well have dessert. And you go to bed feeling so uncomfortable when all you did was make a lousy choice for afternoon tea because you were really hungry and craving sugar because you set yourself up to do it because of the caffeine and the stress earlier in the day. So many people think it's all just a lack of willpower. They recite to themselves, I'm hopeless, I'm pathetic, I've got no willpower. And none of that's true. Our biochemistry is incredibly powerful, and we often will set ourselves up for lousy choices in the afternoon because of our choices in the morning. So, for example, one of the things you might want to consider you know you're going to crave sweet food in the middle of the afternoon. So on a Sunday, you set aside some time and you pre-prepare some good quality foods that are perhaps just subtly sweet, you know, little bliss ball-y type things that have got a decent amount of fat in them, because fat is very satiating. And then subtly sweet, you might use, say, 6 dates in the recipe, which will get split up across 30 balls. And you might have 2 little bliss balls for afternoon tea. So you get the sweet hit on your tongue, but you get a whole lot of nutrition going in as well, and none of the poor quality ingredients that are in poor quality sweet food. So that's one way to start to shift this. Or you might say, okay, I'm going to take a break from caffeine for 2 weeks or 4 weeks and see if that makes a difference to my sugar cravings. Or some of the strategies we've talked about to lower stress hormones might be the way to go. So a couple of ideas for you there. From the emotional aspect, I would ask you to consider, are you looking for sweetness in your life? In other words, are you looking for joy? Do you feel like you have things to look forward to? I often find when people want sweetness, especially mid-afternoon or particularly after dinner, that all day they've thought, oh, I've got that to look forward to. So rather than relying on poor quality food to look forward as the thing that you look forward to, try to get some other things secured down the track that you're going to look forward to. It might be catching up with your favorite person or going to see an art exhibition that you've been busting to see, something that really nourishes your soul. So just explore some of these ideas, because food can't solve these emotional scenarios. So I guess in a nutshell, you want to be really focused on eating plenty of whole and real food. Including lots of veggies can be another little step. Actually, that's something that a patient taught me. She loved sweet food and had always tried to give it up. And she said to me in the consultation, Libby, I'm terrible at giving anything up. I'm just really good at eating more of things. And she said, and I've heard you speak and you just go on and on about how people need to eat more vegetables. And she said, so I thought I can do that. I can eat more of something. I can eat more vegetables. And she started to notice that after making a real commitment to eating more vegetables, her desire for the highly processed sweet food started to fall away because it was so sickly sweet to her. So that would be another strategy for you to consider.
And is that because her taste buds were changing with the increase of vegetables and decrease of sugar?
Most likely, yeah. So theoretically, all your taste buds are brand new every 21 days. So more than 21 days ago, none of the taste buds that you have today were there. So theoretically, that is a huge possibility as to why that happened. I also think we start to feel so much better in ourselves when we eat more vegetables, and then poor quality things, I think they do just maybe psychologically or actually just start to taste yucky to us.
Mm. Gail from Dunedin has our next question. She has a concern about her thyroid. She says, I feel like there is something going on with mine, but my blood test is always normal. Can you please talk more about this?
So, Gail, I love talking about the thyroid. I can talk about the thyroid underwater for a few days, but I won't do that now. Let me just, in a nutshell, give you, an overview of how it works and give you some things to potentially explore. So it's really common for blood tests to come back in the normal range, and I'll get to that in a second. Let's just firstly talk about how the thyroid makes its hormones. Like everything else in the body, it doesn't stand alone. The thyroid gland receives a message from the pituitary gland at the base of the brain to make its hormones. So the pituitary makes TSH, that stands for thyroid stimulating hormone, and that's quite often what your GP will test when you say, I feel like there's something wrong with my thyroid, or if you have some symptoms of an underactive or overactive thyroid, they'll test your TSH. But that's actually a pituitary hormone. It's the one that signals to the thyroid to make its hormones. So it offers great insight. It's a really important test, but I often like to do it with some other ones. The thyroid hormones themselves, so that the actual hormones the thyroid gland itself makes, it makes T4, and that's inactive thyroid hormone. And then that gets converted into T3, which is the active metabolism driving, temperature regulating hormone. So when the pituitary makes its TSH in laboratories in Australia and New Zealand, and I put the word normal in inverted commas, the normal range is usually somewhere between 0.4 and 4. Now, we need normal ranges. It would be chaotic without them, but I have always used them as a guide. Your body and the symptoms a person is experiencing, I use that as the biggest guiding light, because your body knows what's best. So I like to see the TSH sitting at about 1. And quite often when someone feels like there's something wrong with their thyroid, their TSH will be 3. So it's still in the normal range, which is what you have experienced, Gail. So it'll three still in the normal range. So you won't get a call back. You'll be told that there's nothing wrong with your thyroid. However, and we can't do medicine like this, and that's a can of worms, and I won't go into why, but it's not so much, we don't often do it in a preventative way. But let's say we tend to not have blood tests until we feel lousy. But let's say you had blood tests done when you were 26 and at your absolute most outstanding level of health, and your TSH was 1. And now let's say you're 50 years old and your TSH is 3. So your pituitary gland is having to make 3 times the amount of TSH it once did. That's quite a change, isn't it? But it's still in the normal range. So it's not a disease, but your pituitary is having to work harder to get your thyroid to wake up and make its hormones. So then now let's look at, say, T4. In Australian and New Zealand pathology laboratories, the normal, in inverted commas, range of TSH tends to, sorry, the normal range of T4 tends to be between 10 and 20 units. And let's say when you were 26, it made 15 units, so right in the middle of that normal range. And now you're 50, it's only making 11 units of T4. So again, still in the normal range, but the bottom of the normal range was 10 and you're 11. So you're just inside it. So think about that whole big picture. You used to make 1 unit of TSH to get 15 units of T4. Now you're making 3 units of TSH to only get a measly 11 units of T4. Most women with that shift going on, it's not a disease, it's just a shift in thyroid function. Most women will have symptoms of an underactive thyroid and notice a difference in their metabolic rate just with that. So there's other things as well that we can test with the thyroid, and they're called antibodies. The two that we typically test down under are called antithyroid peroxidase and antithyroglobulin. They've got crazy spelling. Don't worry about that. If it's something you want to have tested, you would ask for thyroid antibodies. Please know, though, and I say this with all respect, it is some GPs get into lots of trouble for doing extensive testing. Other GPs are in a position where they can do that. So if it can really help if you want extensive blood tests done, it can help if you offer to pay for them. They're often not very expensive, but it makes the GP feel more comfortable in requesting them. So that's always an option as well. So what does the thyroid need to function well? So what do we need for good, clear communication between the pituitary and the thyroid, and then for the thyroid to be able to make its hormones? The nutrients that are really important, iodine, selenium, iron, and zinc. And we've talked earlier in this audio about how it's very easy for women to be deficient in iron and zinc. Iodine is another real common deficiency. It's never been in soil. It's a sea nutrient. And we had an awareness of it in the 70s when goiter virtually disappeared because the salt was iodized. And then that sort of went out of fashion and people started to use rock salt, and that doesn't have any iodine in it. And unfortunately, we're seeing the return of goiters and other conditions related to iron deficiency now. So you can choose a good quality salt, like a Celtic sea salt or a Himalayan salt. You just need to, whatever one you use, you need to check the label to make sure there's iodine in it. It will state it on the label. And then other sources of iodine, it's a tiny amount in seafood, and then also the beautiful seaweeds, kelp, nori, arame, which is, you can add that easily to soups and stews and casseroles. So just making sure there's some iodine going in. If you're not getting it in any of those forms, you will need to supplement. You only need a tiny amount. It's microgram doses. A female needs 150 micrograms, not milligrams, micrograms a day. And then the other nutrient the thyroid needs is selenium. And again, it's not in our soil. And if a nutrient isn't in the soil, it can't be in our food. But Brazil nuts grown in Brazilian soil are a lovely rich source of selenium. So making sure they're going in as well. So they're the nutrients the thyroid needs to function well. And if we're deficient in any or all of those, it can change thyroid function. Estrogen dominance I talked about previously. We need liver support usually to help with that, but an excess amount of estrogen long-term can suppress thyroid function. Infections can also do it. So if someone has had a history of glandular fever or other infective organisms, other viruses in particular, sometimes they'll say their thyroid function hasn't been the same since then. So sometimes supporting the immune system can also be really helpful. And that's what I mean again about the road in is the road out. So I hope that that's given you some more insight, Gail, about how the thyroid works, because sometimes when even when our blood tests are in the normal range, we can exhibit symptoms. So it's sometimes good to work with someone who can see that, see your history of the changes with your thyroid, if that's possible.
I think that was so interesting what you shared about the blood tests and the normal range. And often we do as patients put the onus onto our doctor. So, you know, you interpret my results, you tell me whether I'm in the normal range or not. But I love what you said about her results at 26 versus her results at 50 in a hypothetical example. Imagine if we as patients had that information ourselves and we could go to our doctor at 50 and say, well, when I was 26, here were my results. And now that I'm 50, look at my results. So I'm, you know, this is not normal for me. And being able to take that information to them, I think is so powerful.
Big game changing, hey? Mm.
Leanne from Vancouver would like to know your suggestions for improving acne, please. Thank you so much.
It can be the bane of our life, can't it? Challenges with our skin. So usually the way acne occurs, it often starts to kick in when our sex hormones first increase around or just after puberty. And with more sex hormones circulating, that increases sebum production. And sebum is the oily substance made by our skin that travels to the surface. And you notice that the skin gets greasier. And with more sebum, we have bacteria, all sorts of infective organisms living on the top of our skin. They live all over us all the time. But our skin has its own immune system and it has a way of stopping those bacteria and viruses from entering. And our skin has what's called an acid mantle. And that word acid is very important. It has a pH, which is a measure of acidity. It has an acidic pH to stop those bacteria from actually entering. And what happens when acne starts, the increase in the hormones increases the sebum. It gives the bacteria that live on the surface of our skin more to feed on. And then often we'll notice our skin becoming a little bit congested. And the way that people tend to think about that is they need to clean their skin better. So they scrub the skin often with really harsh cleaning agents, and that breaks the acid mantle. And then the bugs actually can move into the pores and infect the pores, and a vicious cycle then begins. So we need to break that vicious cycle. Often dietary changes are needed. So the first thing I always would do is to encourage the person to not have any fake food ingredients. So no artificial colors, no artificial sweeteners, no preservatives. Really decrease that processed and packaged food and make a shift to eating towards eating more whole and real food. In clinical practice, I have also seen that some people do very well with a dairy-free diet trial, again, just for 4 to 8 weeks to see if that's going to make a difference for them. And then the liver support is also usually needed. And that's because I touched on this earlier when we were talking about there being too much estrogen, but the liver is essentially responsible for changing the structure of our sex hormones before we're actually able to eliminate them. So when the liver has a lot on its plate to deal with because of lousy lifestyle choices, often because someone might be living on a lot of processed food, takeaway food, soft drink, etc. So when that's happening, the liver can be recycling the estrogen instead of preparing it for elimination and allowing it to be eliminated in our fecal matter and in our urine. And when we recycle our sex hormones, that just then adds to more sebum. So we've got to break that. And often, so often the liver support can also make a really big difference to the acne. So the dietary changes, a dairy-free trial and some liver support is often a good way to begin to break the acne cycle.
Thank you. Jenny from Otago wants to talk about eggs. How many eggs can I eat per week? Can I eat them daily? I love them, but I remember reading you can eat too many. Does that still hold true?
Jenny, do you know how many times I'm asked this? So it's just so, it's so confusing out there for people. So it's so good that you have asked this because it's a question on lots of people's lips. I love eggs. I rate them highly. It's fine for you to have them every day. But the reason they're fine to have every day is because they're a whole real food and they are highly nutrient dense. So eggs contain virtually all the nutrients humans need, the variety of them, not enough of them, but the wide variety of them, except for a couple of minerals like calcium and magnesium. that they're in the shell and we don't eat the shell. So little eggs are incredibly nourishing for us. The reason that they were once thought of as not being so good is that there was concerns that they would impact someone's cholesterol negatively. But one of the things I talk about in all my work, and including in the course, is the way the liver is essentially responsible for cholesterol staying in the body or leaving the body. And also, when you have a blood test for cholesterol, 80% of that total number, so 80% of that cholesterol has been made by the liver, and your diet contributes only 20% to that. So we certainly need to eat in a fantastic way to have great cholesterol levels that are right for us, but eggs aren't going to elevate that. So that was why they got lousy press. If someone's cholesterol is elevated, the first thing I always think is that we need to look after their liver. And often that often involves dietary change, particularly related to alcohol, excess alcohol, excess processed food, etc., all the liver load as we talked about earlier. But as far as your egg consumption goes, there is not a problem in the world for you to enjoy eggs each day. And I also think it's important to listen to your body. I think sometimes when, if you have eaten them every day for a while, eventually you'll go, I don't want that anymore. I need a break. And so listen to that, and then you'll start to choose something else, and then you'll drift back to eggs a little bit later. So your body can be a wonderful guide for you as well.
Our next question is from Lorraine from Brisbane. She says, can you please explain why the sleep we get before midnight is worth twice as much as the sleep after midnight?
Yes, our grandmothers were right in saying that. And the reason predominantly is that around 2 a.m., a huge number of changes occur with our chemistry. So the first thing that often happens is the glucose we received from our dinner starts to drop out of our blood. So our blood glucose levels start to go too low, but the body has mechanisms in place so that the glucose doesn't go too low, which is where we send a signal to the liver and the muscles to release the glycogen, convert it back into glucose, and it'll just prop up our blood glucose levels until we get up and have our brekkie. So around 2 a.m., that's usually when that crosses over and the message is sent to the liver and the muscles to release the glucose. So some people notice that because adrenaline is one of the hormones the body can use to get that release of the glycogen from the liver. The other big shift that happens around 2 a.m. is our cortisol starts to rise. Now, you might link cortisol to being stressed, and an excess of it certainly is. But cortisol is something we make all the time inside of us. And if we make it in the right amount, it can really be our friend. It's when it's too high or too low that it's a problem. But at around 2 a.m., our cortisol naturally starts to rise. It's a very powerful anti-inflammatory substance. That's one of the good things it does. And it's in the right amount, it's also fantastic for our energy. So it starts to increase at around 2 a.m., and so again, and that prepares us to get up, ideally with energy, which often so many people don't experience, unfortunately, these days. But please think, if you don't wake up with energy, it's not necessarily because your cortisol is low. It could be, but there can be lots of other reasons. But to keep it to being about this question, because I can go off on lots of tangents, often it's our blood glucose switching over and that surge in cortisol. Because it gives us energy, some people notice a bit of a shift there, and they wake up and their sleep's not as deep because that cortisol is giving them energy. So they're two really common changeovers.
And our last question is from Rachel from Wellington. I'm intolerant, not allergic, to a few foods, the main offender being mushrooms. Sometimes I am okay to eat them with no reaction. However, I'm finding my food intolerances get worse when I'm stressed. Is there a link between stress and food intolerances?
Rachel, there can be numerous mechanisms through which stress messes with digestion and therefore leads to food reactions. So if you can imagine, the digestive system is like a big long tube, almost like a hose. And in the small intestine, which is where we absorb all of the goodness, all the vitamins and minerals out of our food, if you can imagine that section of the tube of the digestive system is lined with bricks, so a neatly packed row of bricks, top and bottom, lining the tube, then what can happen with stress is that the bricks come a distance apart. So there's gaps in the bricks. And so then when we eat foods, you know, they're starting to be broken down. Our saliva and teeth start the job, and then they're the stomach acid and other digestive enzymes continue that process of the food being digested. So it's in minuscule microscopic particles by the time it's there in the small intestine. And you're supposed to absorb all of the goodness out of it, the vitamins and minerals, you know, the zinc, the vitamin C, the iron, etc. But when the bricks are a distance apart, little fragments of food can move from the digestive system out across into the blood. And our immune system can see that it's a fragment of food rather than just a nutrient. And it's only nutrients that are supposed to be in the blood, not little tiny fragments of food. So the immune response will see that there's a foreign substance there. It thinks it's a germ and it mounts an immune response against it. And so that's one mechanism through which stress can lead to what's called increased gut permeability, or in layman's terms, it's become known as leaky gut. And you can start to notice that you're reacting or that you're sensitive to certain foods. The gut has an incredible capacity to heal. Often stress does need to be addressed, though, which is easier said than done, of course, and that can help the gut to not be leaky and your tolerance of the food to improve. So that's one of the most common mechanisms through which stress can lead to those food reactions.
And if someone is stressed and noticing they're experiencing food intolerances, are there some foods that are better to eat during that time while they work to manage their stress?
The ones that they're sure that they do tolerate, when you've got ones that you're a little bit suspicious of, they're sometimes good to put aside through those times. I, of course, am an even bigger fan of getting to the heart of the stress. I always want to dig into that. And I think it's something that I'm really passionate about at the moment, actually, is helping people to see what stress actually is for them. So, and please know I'm not talking about trauma. And I also acknowledge that unfortunately, there's very big and real stress occurring in the world at the moment. But there's also a huge amount of stress that we create for ourselves because of how we think. And that's the part we can change. So when we dig in and actually see, for example, it's not often on the surface, but it's all the ways we seek approval. And sometimes it's loud and proud, you know, I did this, please recognize what I just did. But certainly in a lot of women, I noticed that the way they seek approval is that they're really prepared, really happy to make themselves feel uncomfortable or put themselves out so that other people can be comfortable. And there's beauty in that, and there's kindness and thoughtfulness in that. And that's wonderful. But often when you pull the curtain back on that, you do it because you want people to think that you're kind. You want people to see you in a certain way. So, I love helping people to dig in and see what stress really is for them. And quite often our stress comes when we're worrying that someone is seeing us in a way that is the opposite to how we want to be perceived. So it's a great journey and probably a lifelong journey for all of us examining that. But do that, and that is a big game changer for our digestive system. And, you know, I giggle as I say that, but I giggle because it feels so big, but it's the most breathtaking thing and one of the things I've been really honoured to witness in supporting people with their health is that big shift from that endlessly stressed feeling and the digestive system improvements that can come. Because when you have digestive system problems and you feel like you react to just about everything sometimes, and your digestive system is the bane of your life, you feel like a glass of water bloats you, it's the most extraordinary thing when that is no longer an issue. And I don't say that lightly.
That's the end of our questions for today. Thank you so much for joining us and making space in your day to listen. We hope you enjoyed our chat and learned a lot. I know I did. If you're interested in having a greater understanding of how your body works and would like the opportunity to send your questions to Dr. Libby, you can enroll in our upcoming Weight Loss for Women course. The next intake starts in April, and we're actually offering a 50% discount, which is a saving of $149.50. For April only, we're also offering free access to Dr. Libby's Real Fridge Chef video series, valued at $99. Given the uncertainty in the air at the moment, we hope to help as many people as possible learn how to better support their health and the health of those they care about. If you have any friends or family members who may benefit from joining us in this next intake and would love the opportunity to do it for half the price, please feel free to share this news with them or this audio file. You can also visit our website, drlibby.com, to find out more and to enroll. Thanks again for listening. Have a lovely day.